So I'm very, very glad indeed that Mary had the initiative to put together this little series of three sessions, three classes, and on this theme of compassion in action. And as she said, these are these times call for this these qualities very strongly. These are difficult times in the world, and so that the heart is very much moved, and many people are concerned as to how to cultivate compassion, how to act compassionately, and how to go about that in a skillful way. And so we felt that as the Buddhist teaching has a lot to offer in this domain, that it would be a good idea for us to put on just a little series particularly on this theme. And so it's lovely to see so many of you have made efforts to come out here, even some of you coming out yesterday evening as well. So we apologize for the scheduling confusions. This is not like a test of compassion or patience. It's just an administrative error. So the dating of things, because it's happening over the Thanksgiving period, was a little bit tricky to work it out. So it fitted everyone. Well, this first of these three evenings, what we thought we'd like to do is to explore the very basis of what compassion is, and some fundamental exercises for helping to develop that. So the outline for the evening was I'll talk for about half an hour now, and then we'll have a period of guided meditation. And then after that we'll have half an hour or so for some questions, and then we'll aim to be finishing the evening about 9 o'clock. So, and that'll be roughly the same format for each of these three evenings over these next 3 weeks. The word compassion in English comes from the Latin roots compassio. Passio means to suffer, com means with. So when in our sort of cultural model for experiencing or being with others who are in a state of suffering, is or at least what the word points us to is suffering along with another being. And of course, I mean, that's not the whole story, but certainly there's words contain a lot and carry a lot of meaning and value with them. So oftentimes we find that if we're in the presence of other beings, other people or creatures that are suffering, then our sense of compassion or feeling for that being suffering indeed sort of pulls our heart into that, and we find ourselves suffering along with that other person. Or sometimes we feel guilty because, you know, some other person or someone, some other being is suffering, and that we're trying to empathize, but we just don't feel bad enough. And so we feel like, oh, I don't really care because I'm not in tears. And sometimes that person can be saying, you don't care, you know, because you're not upset like me. And therefore, obviously, this means that you don't care. And I mean, I've certainly been in that state. I'm sure many of us here have been at some point in our lives, even if it's many, many years ago. But and even though that we might mean that very sincerely or be feeling that's quite a genuine, valid outlook, that yeah, that, you know, if I really did care for this person, I would feel upset and miserable like them. But I'm sad that they're feeling this way, but I'm not in that same state. And so we might feel that we're lacking something, or that we're actually hardening our heart, or we're shutting that being out because we're not suffering in the same way. Or we kind of feel like, I really want to suffer like the others, other than that way I'll be, you know, that way I'll be truly compassionate. And you know, not to say that that approach might not have some value with it, but I thought it would be helpful to point out that from the Buddhist perspective, the quality of compassion is not a state of suffering. From the Buddhist perspective, there's nothing in the various different words for compassion that point to that being the person who's let's say witnessing or being together with those who are suffering is also in a state of suffering. There's an empathy, certainly. There's an empathizing with the difficulty and pain that another being has, but it's not a suffering with. So interestingly enough, the word, the most common word in the Buddhist language for compassion is karuna, and that's connected to the word karoti, which means to do or to make. So it's, the word for compassion is contains within it the hint or the urge towards action. It's like, what do you do? Which is an interesting element. But primarily, and what I thought to stress this evening, that primarily the element of Buddhist compassion is that of is probably best described in the word empathy. So it's like an openness of heart to the feelings of others, so that you're able to acknowledge and be open to that feeling, but without implying of being swept up in that. You know, it takes a lot of explaining in English because we don't really have a word that carries that. But this is very much a part of it. And really, over these sessions, hopefully this will be something that we can look at and explore, and people can discover somewhat. But there's this way that we can be completely open to the suffering of others, and yet not confused by that, not suffering ourselves, but yet as a definite connectedness. We're feeling that, and that we're able to, out of that connectedness and out of that that quality of openness, then the action of what can be done can come forth from that quality of sensitivity. And if nothing can be done, then we're also, because of that openness and sensitivity, we're also aware of that intuition that, oh, at this point nothing can be done. It's like there's nothing to do here. And sometimes learning to leave things alone is the most compassionate response that we can make. But, we can relate very much to, even when, again, if someone is saying like, just kindly help me, do something, help me. And that even if the world, some situation or some person is really demanding our assistance, really calling upon that very plaintively, and so we can feel like, well, I'm just a cold fish, I can't, you know, there's nothing I can think of doing, maybe I'm just being stupid or I'm shutting myself down. But sometimes, even if there's a real call for us to do something, sometimes the fact is, right now there's absolutely nothing to be done. But it's not always the case that people are calling out for our help, but we see a situation or we witness it from a distance or we're involved in it somehow, and someone is in a very distressed state. And actually the kindest thing that we can do is, rather than immediately taking some kind of action to make ourselves feel as though we're doing something, to just be able to be still and to just be present and pay attention. So this leads us on to another way of defining compassion that is most explicitly found in the Northern Buddhist tradition, in the figure of Guanyin. And for those of you, most people are probably familiar a little bit with Buddhist iconography. And anyone who's been to City of 10,000 Buddhas, which maybe a few of you have, would certainly have seen many of the Guanyin statues. Guanyin, in northern Buddhist tradition, they have a pantheon of beings called bodhisattvas, which are those beings who have committed themselves to the full enlightenment and accomplished skills, the teaching skills of a Buddha, fully enlightened Buddha. And the pantheon of bodhisattvas, you know, each of these great beings have sworn not to to leave the cycle of birth and death until they've reached full Buddhahood. They specialize in particular themes or particular skills. So you've got Samantabhadra, who is the skill is or the particular focus is great strength. You have Manjushri, whose great skill is wisdom. Guanyin, her great skill is compassion. And one of the significant things is that the name Guanyin, or the full name is Guanxiyin, literally means the one who listens to the sounds of the world. And in Sanskrit, the name is Avalokiteshvara. And so that the figures of Guanyin sometimes you see as a fairly androgynous figure, sometimes with many arms and hands, each holding different implements, often with an eye in the middle of the palm of each hand. And sometimes the one at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, they actually on the main shrine, the central image is a Guanyin image, and the image has 1,000 hands, and each hand has an eye in it, and the central ring of hands has of 42 hands in the center. Each one has a different implement, like a book or a lotus flower or a sword or a mala bead, different kinds of things. And what this is symbolizing is not that Guanyin is a sort of the most awesome multitasker, you know, but probably she is, but that. It's representing that compassion is this sort of infinitely varied resource of skillful means whereby we can help other beings. So drawing upon compassion, so that if someone needs fierceness, then there's a sword. If they need intelligence, then there's a book. If they need comforting, then there's a bottle of nectar, of sweet dew of peacefulness. So that Guanyin, this represents, even though in the figures, also sometimes with that you get other figures which are much more feminine in nature and only have two arms and hands. And usually in one hand she has a bottle which contains a sweet dew, which is like the nectar which is comforting to suffering beings, and in the other hand a little sprig of willow. I'm not quite sure what the willow symbolizes. But either way, the figures are representing this quality of the heart, and particularly this represented through the name of Guanyin. Well, that is the key element is that of listening. And I feel this is really crucial to us in the West, where we tend to think of compassion, especially compassion in action, as like, you know, do something. That and I can be a pretty impulsive person myself, and I can, and this is a very much a doing culture. You know, this is the land of the Protestant work ethic, and the get up and get at it, and you know, do something mentality. So that oftentimes when we see difficulty or we see problems, we jump right in. And we can often, with a good intention and you know, a lot of energy and unselfish effort, but as we all know, you know, the road it's not, you know, the road to Ukiah that is paved with good intentions. It's like out of our good intentions, we often create far more problems. We create, you know, hellish difficulties for ourselves and others. Often by jumping into things with good intentions, but not a lot of wisdom or sensitivity to what is actually needed. So to me, it was intriguing when I first heard of this deity or bodhisattva Guanyin. What the name meant? I thought, that's interesting. Why should compassion be based around listening? Isn't that interesting? That's Because my immediate association was with doing stuff, you know, that you're compassionate, you help, you lend a hand. But it's this massive clue that, you know, if you want all those thousand hands and thousand, you know, with all their influence to be coordinated, you better have something, you know, very powerful at the center, which is integrating, you know, all of that. Which means for ourselves, the key element to compassion is this quality of listening. And this doesn't just mean listening to, you know, the noises in the street or listening to even the conversation with people around us. But it's a true, deep listening to each moment and attending to what's going on within us, how do we feel, what's our mood, what are the influences being brought to bear on us, what's affecting the people around us. What's guiding what's the situation, what's driving it, what's colouring it, so that in that deep listening, attending, there's a real attunement of the heart that, oh, I'm pretty wired right now, therefore I had probably better not believe too much of what I'm feeling. I am feeling pretty stirred up about this or indignant about that, but it's probably not the right time to speak about it. Maybe I should just sort of wait till I've cooled down a bit, and then if something still needs to be said, then maybe I'll say it. So that kind of thing, when I say attending, it's like, or if it's not you that's in a stirred up mood, it's like, well, you know, this person's very, very excited or very enthusiastic. I think, well, okay, so they're extremely enthusiastic. They just come out of a really difficult situation, and they've come here, and they're now thinking, this is the solution to all my problems. At last I'm free. This is great. This is wonderful. So it's probably best at this moment, rather than to say, yes, you're right, you know, sign here, join up and say, well, to be soothing and calming and a mellowing presence, because yes, they're enthusiastic, but they're a little bit over the top, so perhaps it's not the kindest thing to just sort of feed that so that they totally overdo it. So maybe we should just lean back and let things mellow down a little. So that, this is just small examples of what I mean. And then in meditation, also, and some of the exercises we can look at, it involves this quality of listening. Just listening to our own thoughts, listening to our own emotional patterns, listening to our own mood. And also, because the understanding being the more completely we understand ourselves, then the more we're able to, and can listen to ourselves genuinely, then the more we're able to listen to others. If we're so busy saying, okay, so I'll do that, I'll listen to everybody, and we immediately place it all out there somewhere, and we're still ignoring our own state of being, we need to, in a way, find that radical receptivity, that quality of hearing, where we really are taking it in, and then feeling that in the heart, and then from that heart-centered stillness, then letting that action come forth. So a couple of the other exercises, we'll do one of these with the meditation, in the meditation period. There's a couple of formal ways or technical ways of developing compassion. What it can be, the most simple thing is just that rousing the resolution within the heart to just the wish, you know, may all beings be free from suffering. Just that's the most simple, basic, easy, handleable sense of compassion. Just to raise that thought, that may all beings be free from suffering. And so that then when we start to apply that, we relate to other beings in terms of their difficulties or their unhappiness in life, rather than saying, oh, this one's interesting, that one's boring, this one's marvellous, this one's a fool, you know, I like this one, I don't like that one, etc., etc. If we instead, what this simple kind of recollection is doing is saying, well, even if the guy is a total fool and is causing all kinds of damage, there's probably he's also suffering. And if he was suffering less, then maybe he might behave a little bit more skillfully. So, yeah. Interesting way of thinking about it, right? So that then, just to arouse that simple wish. Another exercise is called replacing self with other. And this is an interesting exercise to do, particularly if you're feeling hard-hearted or critical of other people. And we easily find ourselves judgmental about others. We find that there's a lack of compassion towards other beings. Then to use a kind of imaginative exercise to say, okay, well, if I was that person, you know, I see, if I was that person, how would that be? If I was in their position, so you know, then the mind is ranting off, you know, she shouldn't have done this, she didn't do that, I can't believe she did this. And so then to say, okay, well, let's just replace, you know, let's just switch roles. Let's imagine myself being that person. And that walking through their day or their life or what they're trying to do. And then what we find is very easily when we just do, it's not any kind of, you don't have to do a whole rewriting somebody's entire biography, but just visualizing that within ourselves. And we find that we find ourselves much more understanding of, like, well, of course, you know, that person, they're trying to do the best. They're not actually deliberately setting out to harm people. They're actually trying to do, they're just trying to do a job. They actually maybe even have the same goals as me. It's just that they're going about them in a slightly different way. As an example of this, I found in conflict with my father for pretty much the entire time from when I was about 12 to 20. No, maybe 9, kind of 18. But all through early teen era, it was extremely stressful and amazing amount of arguments. And that I just couldn't believe what a pig-headed fascist he was. And I, of course, was a sort of enlightened and wise, good person. And that he was completely unreasonable. And he should change. It's obvious. He just needs to change. He needs to straighten up and drop all these terrible views he has. Like, I had evidence, you know. You know, could name dates, places, people, you know, incidents. You know, had data to back me up. And so it wasn't actually until I'd already been in the monastery and practicing meditation for quite a few years, until I was really in my late 20s, early 30s, before I really started. It was kind of when I got to the age that he was, when he met my mother. I began to think, okay, now he was this age when he got married. He was this age when he met my mother. He was this age, sort of. And so that I began to be able to see myself as him. And so then I started to sort of go back through his life and really think about what had unfolded there. And he actually had a very painful life. He had he was the youngest child. He was an unexpected fifth child, you know, many years younger than his last sibling. His mother was very sick with eczema and was alcoholic. His parents were both born in the 1870s. So he was like the youngest child of growing up in an Edwardian household. His dad was a doctor in the East End of London, so dad was always busy, mum's always drunk. He's the last child. And then both of his parents died when he was 17. Mother died of a heart attack, father died of cancer. So I kind of walked myself through that, and I thought, gee, but if I had a childhood like that, where your mum sort of collapsed drunk half the time, and dad's always busy, and you know, all your brothers and sisters are sort of off doing their thing. Yeah, I really want something in this universe to be dependable. You know, I'd end up being a bit rigid about my views and opinions, and yeah, I'd probably be a fascist as well. Because you want something that's going to be predictable and stable, and at least something to hold steady in this life. And I found that just that just walking myself just through his life, and not in any kind of hugely comprehensive way, but just like going through the sequence of events, I found this enormous sense of, wow, that's really difficult. I'm amazed he came out as well as he did. Well, he does a pretty good job, really. And I felt this incredible compassion. I was astonished by that, because particularly sitting side by side with this vitriolic diatribes that I would launch at him when I was a teenager, and I felt this incredible softness towards him. Another being that we find ourselves very uncompassionate towards is ourselves. Yeah, that we can have incredible amount of compassion for the homeless people and for endangered species. You know, the wonderful salmon, the coho salmon, we can have work night and day and get all kind of grubby in the stream beds and work hard here and there, doing all kinds of things for others. But when it comes to me, well, no, I deserve to be criticized and judged severely, right? That we can be easily our harshest critic. So another similar kind of imaginative exercise that I like to suggest in this way is, if anybody here does happen to have the habit of being self-critical, I mean maybe one or two have felt that now and then, that if you're having a good sort of lashing at yourself, then and criticizing yourself because of some shortcoming, imagine that say you're married, okay, and that say I'm just use you as an example. So Mary is in this great lather about how terrible she is, and she's a total fraud and hopeless and a useless mother and a pathetic yoga teacher, and what's the world going to do when they find out? They're going to throw me out of town and they'll sue me for millions of dollars and I'll be revealed as a complete incompetent twit. And I just shouldn't be this way. And then, so when the mind is going off like that, then the exercise would be to say, suppose Mary was my best friend. So it's like you step out, sort of outside of your own persona, and then your friend Mary comes up to you and says, oh, I'm so terrible, I'm so awful, I'm the worst yoga teacher, I'm a complete fraud, and I'm going to fail all these people, and I'm hopeless as a wife and as a mother. And see, what immediately comes up in the heart? Mary, you're not that bad. You're actually a very nice person. And when you do this exercise, I've done this a lot myself, and I've carried it's amazing how instantaneously you are far more forgiving for other people than you are to yourself. And it's like, it doesn't take a second. It's like, come on, it's not that bad. Yeah, okay, maybe they will arrest you, but... I'll come and visit you. I'll bring you care packages. You know, you're fine. So this is a very—it's called replacing oneself with others. So that—and it can be really helpful to just see how harsh we can be to ourselves, and how we're summoning forth that kind of very matter-of-fact kindness towards others. Yeah, to ourselves as we would do towards others. And the last kind of practice which we'll do in the meditation period in a minute is a Tibetan, a particular Tibetan kind of yoga called giving and receiving, which is Tonglen in Tibetan, which maybe a few of you are familiar with. And this is done together with the breathing meditation on mindfulness of breathing. And it really needs to be, in a way, established on this basic sense of listening and attending, and a stillness of mind, so that you spend a bit of time just focusing on the breath to begin with, and really being conscious of the mood that we're in and how we're feeling. And in a way, basically trying to sort of clarify and bring things to a stillness at home base, first of all. And then from that clear and stable basis, with using the breath, then with the in-breath, then you visualize taking in the suffering of other beings. And you can limit it to one other being or a few others that you know are in difficulties, or groups of beings, or make it much broader to be, you know, all the beings of the world, or all worlds, you know, whatever. And you visualize breathing in that the suffering as a kind of pungent black smoke, with a kind of pretty, like you see the sort of toxic fumes coming out of a factory chimney. It's like imagining that kind of dark, pungent, cloudy presence, that suffering is embodied in that way, and breathing that in, and then like breathing it into your heart, and letting your heart be like a crucible, sort of a chamber of transformation, and then within the heart, then taking all of that painfulness in and transforming it, like as if you were like filters on the chimney. You're taking the toxic fumes, and you're using the power of the heart to burn that up and to transform that into the light of compassion and well-wishing, benevolence, so that then with the out-breath you're breathing out that quality of kindness and so radiating out a light, a brightness towards that individual being or to that group of beings. So this is called giving and receiving, so that you are receiving it, consciously taking on the pain and difficulty of others. And I'm not just sort of gathering it together and collecting it so all their problems are now mine. But there is the crucial piece is that transforming, seeing that we have the capacity to do that, that we can receive that but not suffer because of it, but say empathizing with that pain, that painful feeling, and then responding to it with a heart of benevolence and well-wishing.